Donald Hussig with Cancer Action New York. This is a Cancer Action New York conference call with some U.S. Environmental Protection Agency scientists that are knowledgeable about the record of decision for the GM Powertrain Massena Superfund site in the township of Massena in New York State. I'm going to pass this over now to Larissa Romanowski with the U.S. EPA.
Hi, good afternoon. Again, this is Larissa Romanowski. I'm a public affairs specialist stationed out of our Hudson River field office in Hudson Falls, New York. Mr. Hussig, you and I had corresponded by email, and in that communication, you'd expressed an interest in speaking with some members of our staff about the GM Messina site. I'm joined on the call today by several of my colleagues who are based out of our New York City office. They are Ann Kelly, who is the EPA Remedial Project Manager for the GM site, Joel Singerman, who's chief of the Central New York Remediation Section, Marion Olson, Human Health Risk Assessor, and Mike McGowan, who is the chief of our Intergovernmental and Government and Community Affairs Branch. Is Doug Fisher there as well?
Yes, I'm here, Melissa.
Okay, and in addition, also Doug Fisher from our Office of Regional Council. And Mr. Hussig, is there anyone else joining you today on the call?
There's not.
Okay. As requested, we set aside about 45 minutes for this discussion. We'd like to begin the call just by addressing some of the topics that were communicated to us via email. Specifically, you would request to speak with EPA staff who are knowledgeable about the scientific information on PCB exposure and health effects that was utilized in the creation of the ROD. You'd expressed an interest in discussing respiratory PCB exposure, PCB carcinogenicity, and the endocrine disruption effects of PCB exposure. And in addition, you also had a general inquiry and some interest in discussing the disease problems that exist on Racket Point and throughout the rest of the Akwesasne Reservation. So I guess to get us started here, what we'd like to do to begin is just to address these particular topics. And obviously, if you have any follow-up questions or clarifying questions, we're happy to address those at the end. So at this point, I'm going to turn things over to my colleague, Mike McGowan in New York, and he will go ahead and start things off for us.
Hi, Mr. Hussig. You're definitely going to hear from three different people at different times, Joel Singerman, Ann Kelly, and Marion Olson. And at this point, I'm going to hand it over to Joel, and you can begin this conversation.
As part of a remedial study at a site, EPA conducts a baseline risk, human health risk assessment and ecological risk. A baseline risk assessment is an analysis of the potential adverse human health and ecological effects from exposure to releases of hazardous substances from a site in the absence of any actions or controls to mitigate such releases under current and future land, groundwater, surface water, and sediment uses. The baseline risk provides the basis for determining the need to take action at the site and identifies the contaminants and exposure pathways that need to be addressed by the remedial action. Ann?
Hello?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. The cell service is a little dicey where I am.
So do you want to pick it up from...
Sure. Yeah, Joel was just talking about the sort of basis for our remedial action and the baseline risk assessment. At this site, we have PCBs are our primary contaminant of concern, and our baseline risk assessment reviewed the health assessment from exposure to PCBs in various media, soil, sediments, groundwater, fish and wildlife, and that was looked at both on the GM property and on residential properties at Akwesasne. The specific exposure pathways from the site were considered to be ingestion of wildlife containing PCBs. There was also infant ingestion of breast milk. There was that breast milk study in the late 80s, early 90s that addressed bioaccumulation of PCBs, ingestion of drinking water as a potential route where I don't think anybody at the time was drinking groundwater or it wasn't considered a potable source, and ingestion or ingestion and dermal contact of PCB-contaminated soil or inhalation of PCB-contaminated dust. So those pathways, inhalation of dust and additional pathways, the dust and dermal contact while swimming in the river or creek there were not specifically evaluated during that assessment because those routes of exposure were considered to be minor compared to the other potential exposure pathways at the site. So the exposed populations evaluated included St. Regis Mohawk tribal members and Canadians downriver of the site, as well as GM workers. I just want to check in that you can all hear me.
I can hear you very well.
Okay, good. Okay. I just want to make sure I wasn't just rattling off here. So, Marion, do you want to talk about some of the risk assessment assumptions?
Okay. Well, first, in the risk assessment, we evaluated exposure for non-residential uses based on the information about the site. In addition, since the St. Regis Mohawk Indian Reservation contains the closest residential population to the site, the tribe was also considered the exposed population for purposes of calculating exposure assumptions in the risk assessment. And we also had a quantitative human health risk assessment and ecological evaluation, and this was used as the basis for the decision, the two records of decision that were signed for the site. And we evaluated both current and future risks. Anne, do you want to talk about the remediation?
Right. So there's the short-term risks associated with cleanup. We manage them in a number of different ways, preventing release through while we're digging out by keeping the areas wet. There's constant dust suppression activities that go on during the remediation, and that prevents release to the air and potential inhalation exposure. We also cover any excavation areas at the end of the day using there are several different methods that we use. There's a thick foam that is sprayed on with like a fire hose that covers the entire area. There's another sort of clay-like substance that can be sprayed, or sometimes if it's a smaller area, that can just be covered with some plastic tarp to eliminate any risks that could come overnight or particularly in the early morning hours. So we manage those potential exposures on site, and we do multiple levels of testing as well. We do air monitoring during the work, sort of in different levels based on distance to the site, or we just have sort of rings of sampling. So workers have monitors on them for PCBs. Then we have right outside the work zone additional monitoring, work zone monitoring. Then we have fence line monitoring, which is like at the edge of the property. And then we have community monitoring. And so we have resident monitoring at residents on Racket Point Road. There are three residences or three properties, and we've moved the monitors over time, but we do 24-hour day, 7 days, or not 7 days a week, but we do 24 hours a day whenever we're working on the site and collect a continuous sample. And we take those high volumes so that we can get very low detections of PCBs while we're in active remediation. And the readings that we have been, we've had very good, pretty good track record with the dust and PCB levels from the site. That information is all available online, and I can direct you to when that gets uploaded as it becomes available to us. And that kind of sums up the monitoring and dust suppression and the efforts we take to reduce inhalation potential. And we also control all runoff, stormwater, all surface water, groundwater, anything that comes in contact with the contamination during remediation gets contained on site and diverted to a treatment system, a few holding ponds and eventual treatment. So those are really the measures to reduce risk that we take during remediation. And then I think there was one other question. Well, we had at one point in your email about diseases on Racket Point, and I don't
know
if we can address
that. Yeah, very interested
in
seeing how much work is being done to make use of the growing body of information about what health effects are occurring from the PCB exposures there on the Abu Dhabi Reserve.
Okay. We would recommend that, this is Marion, recommend that you contact the New York State Department of Health. They have a Bureau's Environmental Exposure Investigation, and they have access to data reported in the state and would be able to address that question more specifically. And we can give you the name of the person to contact at New York State DOH.
Okay, so then the New York State Department of Health is the responsible party as far as bringing into, play, making use of the information about the health that now exists amongst the people there at Abu Dhabi that can be attributed to PCB exposure?
That's right.
Okay.
And then I believe there were a couple of other questions you had about volatilization of PCBs. And this is currently an area of ongoing research by EPA and other federal agencies, and we are coordinating with those agencies on the conduct of this type of research. So staff within the agency are aware of it and monitoring reports that are being published reports that will be published in the future. At the current time, PCBs are classified by EPA as a probable human carcinogen, and we have a cancer slope factor, and that is used in the calculation of cancer risks at Superfund sites. And you also had a question about endocrine disruption, which is, again, an area of ongoing research by the agency and other federal agencies. So we do have staff at the agency that are evaluating this pathway and this health effect reflecting the current reported studies in this area.
And has there been any decision-making at EPA to bring into use that, that science that exists on the endocrine disruption and the respiratory exposure?
The agency, when it does assessments for the toxicity of chemicals, would bring in the information that's currently in the published literature and evaluate it.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to get at is the baseline risk assessment for the GM Messina site, that was produced by Gradient Corporation, and it was used in the creation of the record of decision for this particular Superfund site. Well, that baseline risk assessment, that was published in 1989, and so here we are 25 years later, and there's been a tremendous amount of scientific literature published, peer-reviewed scientific literature about PCB exposure and health effects, especially with regards to the endocrine disruption that's involved with the thyroid, functional thyroid gland, and development of the cognitive parts of the brain's development. I'm quite certain in utero and also for sure in infancy and childhood. And there's research been published by David Carpenter about these particular effects occurring at Abu Dhabi. And then there's the matter of PCB exposure being linked to diabetes. And there's been research published to show that there is an elevated rate of diabetes on the Abu Dhabi Reserve. And then in addition to that, there's the matter of the respiratory exposure. I know you said that EPA was studying that and looking at the literature on that, but it just seems like some point there is decision-making done. And WHO, in March of 2013, they had a meeting in the International Agency for Research on Cancer. They brought together world-renowned scientists that were familiar with PCB toxicity and exposure, and then they put a lot of emphasis on the importance of the respiratory exposure route. And there was a decision made to list PCBs now as known human carcinogens, class 1 human carcinogens by the International Agency for Research on Cancer. So I'm hoping that the hard look that EPA is giving to both the respiratory exposure science and the endocrine disruption science would cause EPA to consider taking further action on this site, because the respiratory exposure, to me, it seems like that is something. I've talked to David Carpenter about it. David Carpenter, MD, he's the director of the SUNY Albany Institute for Health and the Environment. And the last word that he said to me, you know, his last thoughts on the GM powertrain site there at Abu Sazni was that there had to be action taken to break the exposure pathway, to stop the exposures that occur in the respiratory exposures. So either removal or some kind of cover that would be sufficient to prevent any kind of evaporation from the sites, the contaminated soils and sediments that exist there. And not just with that site, he said the whole area, with the that Alcoa landfill that contains PCBs from their remediation down there at Alcoa West, and there with the Reynolds facility, and then in addition to that, the GM, that there wouldn't be any evaporation of PCBs from these contaminated areas because of the importance of the respiratory exposure as a contributor to harm to human health with regards to people living there at Abu Sazni. And so I'm just hoping that eventually EPA will take that information into consideration, you know, that scientific knowledge and that those that expert thinking and guidance, and consider in 2015 that being the year five for a review of the plan for cleanup of this site. That all that kind of information would also be taken into account and consideration be given to revising the plan so that it would include either a total cleanup, removal of all the PCBs of significant quantity there, and in addition to that, or otherwise to cap the what's there to the extent that there would be absolutely no evaporation whatsoever and no respiratory exposure out there, and that would address that part of the new science that's been accumulating for the past 25 years, and it's very important that science be used the way I see it.
I think that our cleanup, as it's designed currently, will address those concerns because the landfill will be capped, the east disposal area will be capped, and the other areas will be remediated and covered. And the goal of the current remediation is completely in line with what Dr. Carpenter's findings are. I think that the purpose of that the landfill, the cap on the landfill, is to interrupt that inhalation exposure pathway.
See, the cap that exists there, are you saying that there's going to be a new cap, or that the cap there is sufficient?
There will be a new cap
on the industrial landfill.
Yes.
Oh, that's good to know, because it was my understanding that the way it stood sometime in the recent past was that the cap that was on there was the cap that was going to be left there, and that would be the extent to which that part of the site was remediated. But if there's going to be a new cap for that, that sounds like progress to me.
There will be a multi-layer RCRA cap on the site, yep.
That's great. That's good news.
Good.
As far as the cancer part of the risk assessment, it's my understanding that, you know, when I, you know, looked at the math and read what was provided in, I've not read the baseline risk assessment, but I read the cancer part of the record of decision for this site, and it's my understanding that the mathematics turns out that there's a 4 in 100 excess risk of cancer from the PCB exposure there with that particular site. And it's site-wide. It doesn't have anything to do with any particular part of the site. It's all the exposures that would be considered to come from that site without the respiratory exposure, all those exposures for the whole site adding up to a 4.2 times 10 to the E minus 2, which is 4.2 in 100 cancer risk. And that's a considerable amount of cancer risk. And so I'm thinking that is why that first ROD, the first ROD that was published, was describing the intention to do a considerable amount of cleanup, you know, taking the PCBs down to a relatively low level of presence, you know, low contamination levels.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was this second ROD published that backed away from that, and it allowed there to be heavier concentrations of PCBs left there on the site. And I was just wondering how that decision was made and how that, you know, how that stands with regards to this relatively high cancer risk for the PCB exposure there.
I can speak to that to some extent. The two records of decision, one was for the second one that you're referring to, the operable unit 2 rod, didn't undo any of the previous decisions that were made for sediments and soils. That OU2 rod, the second one, addressed only the industrial landfill and the East Disposal Area. And it was in keeping with EPA policy to contain landfills and not remove them, so that the EDA and the landfill would be consolidated and capped in place. And that's that new cap that I was talking about that will go on there. In the meantime, the two rivers have been remediated. The cove has been remediated to tribal, promulgated tribal standards. The site is approaching completion for remediation to that 10 parts per million cleanup level. And now we're working on the industrial landfill and the East Disposal Area to put that RCRA, that composite cap that I was talking about. Now it has a clay cap on it. That will all be consolidated with some removal of PCBs greater than 500 parts per million, and that will all be consolidated in place and capped. So was that clear?
Well, I just have a little more of clarification that I'm looking for. The cleanup level that was set forth in the first record of decision, that was a certain number, right? I don't remember what that number was.
That was 10.
Of my head.
That was 10 parts per million. Yep.
10 parts per million. Well, see, in my thinking, why wouldn't that 10 parts per million apply to the industrial landfill and the disposal area?
Well, because the industrial landfill and the East Disposal Area were landfills, and they were two large volume landfills, and EPA policy is to contain rather than move landfills. I don't know, Joel, if you want to talk about the presumptive remedy concept.
Yeah, basically, the presumptive remedy is that you have typical remedies that are selected or identified for things such as landfills. So as Pam mentioned, the presumptive remedy for landfills is containment, because it's typically, it's very difficult to remove a landfill. There's not anywhere to put it, and containment is probably just as protective. So the cap that Ann described that will go in the landfill will make them, basically prevent any exposure.
So there'll be no evaporation from those materials there on the GM site once the cap is in place.
That's the intent of the cap, to prevent the releases, yes.
Prevent evaporation.
Well, not specifically evaporation, but evaporation, seeps, infiltration of water, which generates additional leachate. It's basically to be a barrier between the landfill, the waste in the landfill, and everything outside of it. So, yes.
Okay.
And also just to clarify one thing about, just to reiterate what I said in the beginning, is that don't misunderstand the purpose of risk assessment. The purpose of risk assessment is to determine whether or not there's a need to take action at the site. And based upon the high levels of contamination and the risks being outside the acceptable range, we determine there was a need to take action, and the actions that are being taken will rectify the risk.
Well, I understand that the purpose of risk assessment is to basically have some idea of, how bad the problem is and whether something should be done or not. But then in getting into the details of what is done, it does seem to me, am I understanding this right? The reason EPA doesn't want to clean up a landfill is just because it's just too large a quantity of contaminated material to deal with in this way of by the removal route? Is that basically what it comes down to?
Well, not necessarily. There are small landfills really it depends upon. It's a presumptive remedy for landfills is to contain them.
But why is that? What is the thinking behind just saying, well, landfills, we call it a landfill, so we're just going to leave it there and contain it, and then any other place where it is, you just remove it down to the level that is set in the record of decision based upon the risk assessment, and that in this case being the 10 parts per million, I think is what the lady
said.
Well,
the thing is, landfills typically are very large. To remove them would not only costs a lot of money and require some place to put it, you know, disposal location, but in addition, you know, what's the objective of removing the waste is to prevent exposure, to prevent. So if you remove the waste, you can never get all the waste out anyway, because you always have something in the saturated zone which will be exposed to groundwater. So by containing it, you're basically achieving the same objective as removal. If it could be easily removed, then we can remove it. I mean, there are disposal areas where waste is removed. You know, there are examples at the site where there are waste that are being removed. We're not just simply capping everything. It's like the Navy. We paint everything. We're not capping everything. We're removing things that can be removed and things that cannot be easily removed and which will not provide much more protection by removal we're capping. So capping a landfill, that's the basis for the remedy.
I see what you're saying. I have another question about the landfill exposures. The fact that the landfill was put in there without any kind of containment underneath, just being this totally unlined, just right down in the ground and the groundwater landfill, how can what EPA is proposing with the leaving in place and the capping, how can that address the matter of the PCBs and the other industrial chemicals such as mercury and whatever else is in that industrial landfill, this online landfill? How can the capping, and is there anything else that EPA is doing? What's being done about the escape of the chemicals down through the ground in the groundwater?
We have extensive monitoring in that area, and we also intercept groundwater at the landfill, the sort of toe of the landfill, where this site is underlain by extremely dense glacial till, which is it's just very, very hard. We saw when we're digging it, it's just extremely dense. It's hard to dig through. Very competent. You can sort of dig with straight vertical walls without risk of cave-in. And it's not permeable. And it meets the requirement, the standards of permeability for a liner. There is an area of the under the landfill where we detected PCBs. There's only really that one area where we detected PCBs in groundwater, and that was there's a big interception trench that was dug down like 45 feet. It's a couple hundred feet long. A clay plug was put in that area, and any of the groundwater that goes under the landfill in that area is intercepted and captured in a collection system and pumped to the treatment system where PCBs are removed.
Okay.
And that will stay in place, and we'll have more wells put in, and I mean that will be a little bit more that system will be more robust once we complete the capping of the landfill.
Then would it be likely to do you see this, what exists there with the landfill then, as sufficient to ensure that once cleanup was done on the Thompson property there adjacent to the industrial landfill, that there would be no longer any, that no new contamination would arrive there after the old contamination was removed?
Right.
Okay. I guess I just have one more thing that I'd like to just raise up. When I have this, very knowledgeable and involved, I just consider the people with Region 2 EPA that are involved with this site, and including Larissa Romanowski with the Hudson River site. This is a group of people that has a lot of involvement and status and position as far as dealing with PCBs and other hazardous chemicals. And I just like to put the thought out there, the idea out there that considering the fact that there are exposures to fluoride and mercury and dioxin from the contamination of the fish in the St. Lawrence River, that these people of the Agwizazni Reserve were encountering, that these chemicals they were being exposed to during the course of time prior to the GM site existing there and after the during the GM site presence and after it. It was through all this long period of time, there's been exposure to a multitude of chemicals that are known to bioaccumulate. They build up in the person's body, and they biomagnify. They add up and get greater levels in the wildlife and the fish. So considering that, say, those people have had a significant exposure to mercury and fluoride and PCBs and dioxins, these very potent, harmful chemicals, it just seems to me that, like, it would be wise to recognize that that was a very considerable amount of harm, and that thinking about assessing the site for one chemical and then not taking the other chemicals into consideration, that should change, and that it would be wise, considering the level of knowledge that exists now, when we don't know what all the health effects are, and we're finding, say, for example, with dioxins, that now the epigenetic effects that take place with dioxin exposure, where the packaging of the chromosomes is altered to the extent that the offspring for many generations are more susceptible to chronic diseases such as diabetes and reproductive problems and cancer. Considering all that, it just seems to me like that a new paradigm that would better serve the public health and the people would be exposure minimization for known harmful chemicals. So there'd be an effort made to minimize exposure to PCBs and dioxins and fluoride and mercury and, say, lead and arsenic and cadmium and chromium, these well-recognized harmful chemicals, rather than the effort to do risk assessments looking at one chemical at a time and think about how much harm that one particular part of the whole exposure picture might impose, but rather just considering the fact that they're harmful chemicals, and there's been a widespread exposure in a certain place like Abu Ghazni to a large number of them, and considering all the harm that's likely to be causing, and we don't even understand the harm totally, as the epigenetic science is showing with dioxin, that it just, out of all wisdom and concern for protecting the public health, that there be the effort made to minimize exposure, you know, rather than to just figure out how to reduce the exposure some, but without going all the way to really making this full-out attempt to minimize exposure.
I think that our all of our actions at these three sites and the DEC actions and all the other work that has gone on for decades of cleanup in that area is driving just at that point. To eliminate exposures to the extent that is technically practicable, I think. And that doesn't mean, sadly, it doesn't mean making the contaminants go away completely, as most people would like to see. It means, in some cases, just interrupting the exposure pathway, which I think we can successfully do at all of these sites and at GM, at the GM Messina site in particular. But I don't think our goals are different or our expectation is, and I understand your point about the wide-ranging impacts and our understanding of the chemicals, but we have a good understanding of what is there at this site, and that's what we're responsible for cleaning up. There are bigger background issues that I think you're driving at, which we really appreciate. Our mission is to clean up that site, and I think we're successfully doing that.
Well, I agree that there is a growing interest in and an effort being made to make it so there is very little, reduce the exposure in a major kind of way. But to say, for example, the Grass River cleanup that's being proposed and may be taking place, that doesn't go as far as stopping the evaporation pathway, and it doesn't go as far as could be gone as to reduce exposure in a major kind of way. It's a relatively cheap method of addressing the contamination pressure from the Alcoa facility, Alcoa West. And so I have to say that I differ to some extent with you in saying that all of EPA's activities are on the same page as what I'm proposing here, because in my mind they are not, and I don't think they are on other minds either. But I understand what you're saying, that there is an interest, and there's some movement being made in that direction, and that's wonderful. Because there truly has been. There's been a lot of exposure and a lot of harm. And what I'd really like to see happen would be that if there could be, I'm hopeful that in prior, you know, during the process of this 5-year review, with the 2015 being, you know, coming up, you know, next year, that there could be an effort to engage the community there at Aguas Zaldi to the extent that people from EPA and the New York State Department of Health, since they are also very much involved, as far as I understand now, with dealing with the health effects that are happening, that health effect information will be, you know, gathered in and considered carefully in decision-making for the continuing efforts to protect the people from this particular site and the other sites that are in the vicinity.
Mr. Hassick,
because I think that is not, to in my mind, that has not been an awful part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Hassick, we mentioned the Department of Health before. We want to leave you with a contact at the Department of Health. You can ask some of your health questions there. Her name is Wendy Kuehner, K-U-E-H-N-E-R.
Yep, I know Wendy, and I have been in communication with her about an overarching issue, this matter of warning the public, especially the people at Aguas Zaldi, about their continued exposure to PCBs and dioxins and flame retardants and a bunch of lipophilic chlorine-added pesticides like DDT and Myrix and toxavine, you know, just to do that for those people, warn them about the presence of these chemicals in the mainstream food supply. And I'm trying to communicate with Wendy about that, but basically she just said to me there was nothing I could do about it. So I'm hopeful that continuing to speak with her about this particular site and help her understand how important it is for people that have had the excess exposure to PCBs would understand that they continue to be exposed to PCBs in a significant way, along with being exposed to dioxins and flame retardants and these old pesticides that are lipophilic by consuming animal fat-containing foods.
Okay, thanks. I think we're going to need to wrap up.
Okay.
Thank you for your time. And
Yes, I really appreciate the unwillingness of EPA scientists to explain their thinking and their calculations and all this activity that is being brought to bear in dealing with the PCBs on the MGM site.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
All right. Good afternoon.
It's been a Cancer Action New York teleconference call. It's Donald Hussig. I'm the director of Cancer Action New York. We're working with the people of Aguas Zaldi and the people of the United States Environmental Protection Agency to try to bring a result that is best for the people of Aguas Zaldi, and that meaning that the exposures are minimized, all the PCB exposure minimized, the dioxin exposure minimized, the fluoride exposure minimized, the mercury exposure minimized, the old pesticides exposure minimized, and these things can be done. It's a matter of people of good intention discussing the scientific knowledge that exists and then making decisions to do public health messaging that simply provides the public with the information about how they can best take action to minimize their exposure when there isn't any action being taken by government. There's no action being taken by government to keep the levels of PCBs and dioxins and flame retardants and these old pesticides in foods to a level that is safe. No action is being taken on that. There's been some action taken to reduce the quantities of PCBs and dioxins in the environment. Very little effort made to reduce the quantities of brominated flame retardants in the environment. The brominated flame retardants continue to be used in the manufacture of many products, plastics, upholstery, ceiling tiles, various products that are produced, and a concern exists for fire safety. Point being that if people knew they were being exposed to flame retardants and PCBs and dioxins at levels that are known to be causing harm around the world, that the people would have the option then of choosing to change their diet so they were not being exposed in a significant way, in a harmful way, to PCBs and flame retardants and dioxins, but total exposure. We're talking about total exposure minimization, and I'm hopeful that this call is a step toward accomplishing that for the people of Aguas Zaldi and the people of the USA and the people of the world. My name is Donald Hussig. This has been a Cancer Action New York conference call. Thank you very much.